Hey everybody, welcome to the Bloody Awesome Movie Podcast. I'm John Burke, and with me from across the pond, over in his oil fields, is Matt Hudson from whatiwatchtonight.co.uk. I did it again. Matt, how you doing?
I'm doing very well, my friend. I really wish I had the money that those oil fields begat to bestow upon people.
Oh, I meant to say it was olive oil that you spilled earlier all over your field.
It's very slippery. I'd say more vegetable oil, because that's cheaper and easier to come by than olive oil. But and you can fry bacon in it, so bacon is always a win. No, I'm doing okay, my friend. Of course, we're recording a slightly different day and time at the minute, so yeah. I'm going to have to refrain from saying this evening. But I don't know about you. I find there's something comforting when I'm listening to a podcast, the times I actually do. Something when they say, oh, this evening, oh, it sounds really comforting and warming. Oh, this evening, yeah, and not nice drawn in, and we're going to sit down and hear a story or something. I don't know if it's just me or not, but I default to saying this evening. So if I do say that, guys, just pretend it's a balmy autumn's evening and we're talking about tonight's film. But I'm doing well, other than rambling on as usual. How about you? You keeping Florida safe and well?
Yeah, doing my part. It's a cool morning today. We're recording on a Sunday. We record on Tuesdays, I have a super busy week this week, and so we didn't want to wait till the end of the week to record this episode. Dude. So we decided to move up our recording, and for me, it's early morning. It's like, it's 10 o'clock. I've already been to the gym, and that's pretty much all I've done so far today. Gym and shower.
I've showered, but not gym.
Well, that's the important thing. So we are here... in a way, usually we've had time to like watch a bunch of movies and stuff in between. We don't really have that today, but the movie we're here to talk about is rather long. I am not being critical about it. Often, yes, on this podcast, we have made comments about movies being too long, and sometimes we're right. For sure. Like, there are definitely movies that are unnecessarily too long. If the movie keeps me pulled in, if it doesn't feel long while I'm watching it, I don't have an issue with it. It does create other logistical problems, because I do like to watch a movie in one sitting in most cases. I don't enjoy like breaking it into parts, because that's not how the film was designed. But it's much harder to commit to 3.5 hours plus 20 minutes of trailers.
And travel as well, don't forget, JB.
Yeah, and travel, for a movie like this, which this movie is Killers of the Flower Moon, the new Martin Scorsese film that we're going to be talking about here momentarily. But, Matt, you are much more vocal about your distaste for longer films. Scorsese has been pushing back against this. Overall, do you have any comments on the length or the commitment of going to see this?
I feel like Scorsese versus Hudson could be the new Scorsese versus Marvel. Films are getting longer, it would seem, even if they don't necessarily need to be. It becomes quite a relief now when we see a film and it's only 2 hours long, which is wild. And yeah, I will always push back against a film that's too long. It kind of puts me on the back foot when I see a film is 3.5 hours long, because I immediately think, right, if this doesn't need to be 3.5 hours long, I'm immediately not going to be into it. I know there's going to be stretches where I'm going to be out of this. Plus, like you say, just like practically, it's going to take me 25 minutes to get to the cinema and back again. So just shy of an hour, plus 20 to 30 minutes of trailers. This film's 3.5 hours long. We're talking about almost 5 hours. That is a whole evening. That is literally finishing work, eating on the way to the theatre, and watching the film, and then coming home, going to bed. That's not exactly the world's worst problem. I'm not going to try and trivialize this and say, oh, no, nobody in the world has worse issues than me because of that. Absolutely not. But I do feel like longer films, they kind of almost handicap themselves to start with. Now, Scorsese gave us an incredibly long film in The Irishman, which dropped on Netflix the other year, and I actually quite enjoyed that, and I think it just about justified its length. Yes, there were stretches of it that could be taken out, I think. And listen, I don't want to ever sit here and tell Martin Scorsese how to edit his films or how to present his films. Because if anyone has earned the right to deliver these films, it's Scorsese, who's been in the business now for 50 odd years, delivered classics of American cinema, or just cinema in general. You know, he's earned his stripes now, and he seems to be such a lovable guy as well. Just don't ask him about comic book films. However, Killers of the Flower Moon is 3.5 hours long, John, and I don't mean to take away from your initial thoughts. My first, on the runtime though, I think there is an astonishing 2.75 hour film here.
So you think it does run a little long?
With caveats, though, I think I'm going to be on a similar level to you when it comes to the runtime, because I don't know anything. I don't know anything that John thinks about this film, other than I remember him saying the other week that the runtime wasn't quite as, didn't really feel, he didn't notice it was paced well. I think we're going to be on a similar wavelength, despite that prior comment I've just made. So interested to hear what you think there, my friend.
Well, let's get into the stats. Killers of the Flower Moon, directed by Martin Scorsese, obviously co-written with him and Eric Roth for the screenplay. It's adapted from the David Grand book, which has a few more words on it. I think it's Killers of the Flower Moon, something with the FBI or something like that. But I have purchased the book on Audible, the audiobook, and I have yet to listen to it. But I am intrigued, having now seen the film. If you haven't seen the trailers for this, folks, it's got some pretty big stars in it. We got Leonardo DiCaprio in essentially the lead role, which I think some people take an issue with, rightfully so, given the nature of the story, at least. Robert De Niro as William Hale, his uncle. Lily Gladstone as Molly Burkhart. Jesse Plemons shows up at some point, incredibly. I'm reading the order on IMDb. I'm going to read through a lot of these because I think a lot of people deserve to be mentioned. Tantu, Cardinal, John Lithgow, Brendan Fraser, which is way too high on this cast list because he is not in the movie very long. Kara Jade Myers, Janae Collins, Jillian Dion, Jason Isbell, William Bilal, Louis Cancelmi, Scott Shepard. I think I'm getting to a point where I feel like there's a lot of indigenous actors in this film, and I don't think they often get representation. So I don't want to leave someone out. And this IMDb list is unwieldy. You know what? Pat Healy has such a distinct face. It was driving me nuts watching the movie because I couldn't place his name. And like, I'm like, I know who this is. Why can't I figure out who this is? And seeing him, I'm like, duh.
I'd throw in Yancey Redcorn as the chief and Tatanka Mead as well. Very good up and coming actor there. But it's a big cast, which does
giant cast.
Need a big old cast reading, though. Usually we'd skip over some, but we can't here. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I'm still scrolling because the order of this IMDb list does not make sense to me. Because like, Brendan Fraser is way too high on the list, and not in a. You're gonna think I'm. I later when I mention him, you will disregard what I'm about to say. It's not a commentary on his role in the film as much as his. He's just not in it much. He's like a very late addition to the film in terms of the story, and like, it's weird that he's so high on the list. Other than he's the most recent Best Actor winner, so. That would be my assumption why he's so highly billed, but
yes.
Those are the details of the cast and crew that we usually refer to. And then we're going to get into the ratings after I read the synopsis. If you haven't heard what this movie's about, and I honestly didn't know exactly what this movie was, to be honest, going I didn't realize it was based on a true story. I knew it was based on a book, but I didn't know the book was like a true story. The synopsis is, members of the Osage tribe in the United States are murdered under mysterious circumstances in the 1920s, sparking a major FBI investigation involving J. Edgar Hoover, which, of course, is kind of interesting because J. Edgar Hoover has a biopic directed by Clint Eastwood called J. Edgar that stars Leonardo DiCaprio in that role. So, kind of a fun nod there. I've never seen that movie, though. I don't think it's very well regarded. But this movie is right now 92% Rotten Tomatoes score from critics, 84 audience, which is, I wasn't sure how audiences would vibe with a 3.5 hour movie that's based on a true story. Although true crime real popular right now, so not totally surprising that people are vibing with the overall inherent truth. And again, most likely for a lot of people, this will be the first they've ever heard of this story, which is true for me. I did not know anything about this story. Mm-hmm. The stuff like this is what makes me mad about my history classes in high school, because this and the Tulsa situation that I learned about from Watchmen, of all things, the HBO series. I had never heard of the Tulsa. I don't want to misrepresent names and such. the Tulsa Massacre. Black Wall Street is the name I was hesitating to pull. I knew nothing of that until Watchmen, and I knew nothing of the Osage situation until Killers of the Flower Moon film, which I will now listen to the audiobook because I am intrigued by. And I did buy a book about the Tulsa Massacre after seeing the Watchmen, because I, again, had never heard of it, in all of my years of education. I was about to say I have a master's degree, but my master's degree is not in history, so it would be weird if they started teaching that in the IT program, but nevertheless, I think for audiences, I think this story is probably going to be new to them. 84% though, RT audience, 90 Metascore, 8.2 IMDb user score, and a 4.3 Letterboxd. So people are enjoying this movie overall. And I mean, when you hear that cast, even when De Niro or DiCaprio turn in their lesser performances, they're still Leo and Robert. You know what I'm saying? Like, they're still going to be good, even at their worst. Yeah. They have talent. That's not to say I like all of their performances, but it's still like, you're never going to look at them like, they don't know how to act. They do. You know they do. So even when they're phoning it in, there's still like a natural charm and charisma, and even maybe memory in your own head playing a factor that you're like, well, I know they're good. I've seen them be incredible, you know? And that's not to say they're bad here. I actually like both of them a lot. I really enjoyed this movie. Enjoy is a strong word, because it's hard to enjoy. This movie is devastating. And there was a part where the sheer weight of the horrors that were happening in this movie, Lily Gladstone's character is grieving, and all of that hit me at that moment, and it was because of her performance. I was really impressed with Gladstone. I had seen Certain Women. I think I might have seen one other thing she's in, but my memory of Certain Women is I binged a lot of movies that week when I watched Certain Women, so I don't remember specifics at all at this point. I think I watched
Cow, the Kelly Kelly Reichardt film,
which I also saw and liked a lot. But also my memory of that are the two guys. I don't remember almost anything else about that than the cow. In general, I've watched a lot of movies over the last couple of years. If I haven't rewatched it, it's very hard for it to like pull out specifics, this far in. But in this movie, watching it now, Gladstone stood out to me as, she's the emotional center of the film for a multitude of reasons, but her performance alone carries that, and she when she breaks down, it crushed me. Like, it hit hard while watching this, and I was really blown away by her. I think De Niro is scary in like a really cool way. Like, he's not over the top, he's almost too controlled, where that's what makes him so scary, is like he is not afraid of anything, and it's like it's unnerving. And DiCaprio's maybe being a little silly at times, but I always like Leo, so it's hard for me to like, you know, I'm like, nah, he's doing stuff. Plemons shows up, always love that guy, man. Everything he's in, it's funny because this movie's warranted. All of a sudden there's a lot of Game Night memes of him saying the Frito-Lays joke in that movie. I don't know why his role here has brought that meme back all of a sudden, but it's like flooding my channels on socials, and I'm like, okay, I'm here for this. Lithgow and Frasier show up as the lawyers on opposite sides. For this movie does turn into I don't want to say it turns into a procedural. It gets to a courtroom drama, but not really. Like, it's not in the courtroom a lot. A lot of the third act, or I don't know, fourth and fifth act, are in the courtroom at times, but not a lot. But Lithgow, he chews the scenery a bit in most of the, like, in a lot of roles that he's taken. He kind of does here, but I don't know what the hell Brendan Fraser's doing in this movie, dude. Like,
He didn't get the memo, did he?
Are you on the same page with me on this? Because
I love seeing Brendan Fraser's name on the cast list. Couldn't fathom what the hell he was doing screaming and shouting in this film.
God, dude, it seems to be splitting Twitter. Like, there are people who think his performance is incredible, and then there's us, apparently, who are like, what is happening? And I think he's incredible. I love Brendan Fraser. And I'm just like, what is he doing? And Sean has a take he likes it, has a take that I'm like, if I had that mindset, maybe it wouldn't have registered the way it did. But yeah, I was like, when he showed up, I'm like, oh great, Brandon Fraser. And then like 2 seconds in, I'm like, what is he doing?
Just shouting. Literally.
He's just shouting. And it feels like he's reading lines. Like Scorsese's like, here, say this. And he's just regurgitating this script, which I think does make sense. Cause the lawyer he knows he's lying, right? Like there's every word he's saying, he knows has been fed to him by William Hale, but it still feels like it could be a believable performance. Cause it's not believable. It's like, wow, this guy's
say, please.
Yeah. I was really surprised at that. Like of all the things I actually really like Pat Healy's kind of like as the FBI guy. He's stoic looking and he almost reminded me of Flea from the Chili Peppers, like the few movies that Flea's been in. Just like his look and his kind of demeanor. But I'm often a fan of Pat Healy, but I liked him and the whole FBI angle was interesting. And so listeners, we didn't say this, but this is a true story, but it's a true story a lot of people aren't familiar with. But we're not going to do a spoiler episode for this. We're not going to spoil specifics. We're not going to tell you who did what or how the results. I mentioned a court case. I didn't even say who's on trial, right? Like we're leaving a lot of details out in the air. But we are going to mention how this film chooses to tell us the ending. We're not going to tell you the ending. But this movie has we get voiceover, right? Like we hear narration a few different times throughout the film from different characters. But there's no framing device in the film. Like we're not shown that we're hearing this story from, you know, like a withering grandmother telling her granddaughter the story of her lost love and Edward Scissorhands. Like we're not getting that kind of framing or wraparound device that would introduce how this film chooses to end, because we're in this intense scene where two characters are addressing a major element that we have known. The dramatic irony is at its high. Like we know the truth, and a character is asking another character for that information that we know.
Yep.
And the way that plays out is really tense. It's really, you know, it's sitting and you don't know what's going to happen. And if you're me, you have a clear, I want this to happen. I want this thing to take place because it's the only right thing that could happen here. And then we cut to what by today's standards would have been a true crime podcast, but it's set in the time period. So it's a talk radio show that has all of the bells and whistles of like the sound effects. Cause it's pre TV. So it's like, you know, if you're at home, you're listening to a radio show. And
DIY sound effects.
Yeah, which are really cool to watch people doing. And I didn't catch, I didn't realize this until way later. Tuna actually is the reason I even know this. But Jack White is one of the guys in that
I
sequence.
I saw that, because I was like, do you know, like you with, was it Pat?
Pat Healy.
Yes, I was like, who is that guy? And then it wasn't until afterwards, I was like, it is Jack White. Yes, very cool.
Yeah, and I guess Sean knew Jack White was in this and was looking for him throughout and then didn't even register that it was him in the part that makes the most sense. I didn't register that, so I don't know. Is he playing the piano? Is he that guy?
No, he's playing one of the, I guess he's playing an instrument, but he is more of an actor in the scene.
So it's a weird choice. It to me, and I said this in my written review, it feels more like something out of a Wes Anderson movie than a Scorsese film to cut to this, you know, weird framing device that had not been introduced yet in the film. But the implication being that all of the story, all of the, at least all of the legal stuff, is being told to us through this talk radio show, essentially. And it's an interesting choice. It's not, I don't dislike it, but it felt like it came out of nowhere. And, the rare, I don't think it's a spoiler to say Scorsese is in the scene.
He's in quite a few of his films.
He is, but he's not, I mean, like a lot of times he's like a real quick, like he's like in the taxi and Taxi Driver, like, you know, like, it's like more of a Hitchcock cameo, right? Where it's not important to the plot. He's clearly feels that this message is so vital that he himself should deliver it. Especially since he is taking on this story to tell.
What do you think of that part?
Do, I think it works. I'd like to see it again. It was jarring in my first viewing. You know, like, yeah. Now that I know it's coming, I think maybe I would be better prepared. It does feel like it comes out of nowhere. Almost like he couldn't have finished the film if he didn't summarize that part. You know, like, it would have been 4.5 hours. Like, you know what I'm saying? Like, if he had shown us all of the stuff that the radio show tells us, maybe it's another hour-long movie. And he's like, I gotta truncate this somehow. I'll just tack it on at the end. Yeah, so overall, I really like this film. I think Gladstone, to me, was the biggest highlight. I thought this moment was weird, but not bad, just unexpected. And I've seen all of Scorsese's films. I can't say I remember all of them. And he's done some weird stuff. I don't remember him ever doing this kind of cut to a framing device like that, that I can recall. If so, it would be in maybe one of his more recent, because I've only seen Irishman once. And
I've seen Silence.
Yeah, no, and I don't think so. But overall, I'm very positive on this film. I don't think this is Scorsese's best, but I would rather rewatch this than The Irishman. Even though I think Joe Pesci is incredible in The Irishman, I was much more engaged in this story, partly because I couldn't believe it was real, and I was again upset that I didn't know the story. And I think this story has a more important message for us to know than The Irishman. Like, yes, The Irishman is based on a true story, but I don't feel like I gained anything learning that story. Where I feel frustration that I just learned this story. You know, like, I feel like I should have always known this story. But Matt, what about you? What was your take on Killers of the Flower Moon?
This is one of my in the Bampies that we dropped at the beginning of this year. This was one of my five films I was looking forward to most. Man, it's a Scorsese film. Why wouldn't it be, almost?
Yeah.
And I have comments on that. But just on that last part you mentioned about, you know, watching this rather than something like The Irishman, you know, I'm not subjective, not going to disagree on that. But I do find with Scorsese's more recent efforts like this, The Irishman and Silence, they're not films I really want to go back to. And I'll say that about Killers of the Flower Moon as well. That isn't my take on the film, but having watched it now and absorbed it and experienced it, I can't imagine myself sitting there thinking, damn, I cannot wait to go through that again. I cannot wait to sit through this again, because it's a heavy film, very heavy film. And it's also very long. And on that, I also give props to Apple TV. You know, people knock streaming services. Apple TV Plus have said to Martin Scorsese, here's $200 million. Do you. Go and do you. And we're going to put it out. Do you know why? Because we're Apple. And we make tens of billions of dollars every month. So it doesn't matter. Yeah. We're going to put it out in the theatres. It isn't going to make any money. That isn't, again, it's a 3.5 hour film. But then Oppenheimer did. It's not going to make its money back in theatres, I don't think. Or certainly isn't going to, it may break even, I don't know. But for Apple, they are putting that entire artistic integrity ahead of profits because they can, for one, because they get so much. But I love that. And also Napoleon coming up in a couple of weeks is also produced and financed by Apple TV.
Yeah.
So we're getting these classic directors, legendary directors, being given carte blanche, and I will never, ever, ever begrudge that. I think it's great. And I love the fact that in 2023, we can get something like Killers of the Flower Moon, a big sweeping Western drama epic, $200 million budget. How many other studios are financing this? And it's 3.5 hours long. None.
Yeah.
Realistically, none. And if they do, will they have the license that Scorsese clearly has here? No, it's a fact. I think for me, as objectively, no other studio has given a Scorsese this chance. And I'm so glad Apple TV Plus did. That said, I liked the film. I didn't love the film. I liked it, though. Some of it was the runtime. I do think in the second part, I think it slows down a little bit too much in there. And it really picks up when Jesse Plemons' character comes in. That's when you almost get like a tonal shift as well in the film. And Jesse Plemons is always, 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 always very good. And on the performances, I agree. And it's become a bit of a standard take now, looking online. But Lily Gladstone is so very good in this. She's got this simmering, quiet intensity throughout. She didn't even need to say anything. But then when she... Like you mentioned, when she has to show her emotions, or when she hits breaking point, my God, you know, is that something to behold? And it's the rawness of her performance throughout is astonishing, really. And I'm not really au fait with Lily Gladstone's career. I've seen First Cow. I haven't really seen anything else. But when I saw her on the marketing and the call list, I wasn't thinking, oh, cool, I know who that is. I was like, okay, cool. Look, there's DiCaprio and De Niro. And now I'm thinking it's the other way around now. She's really very good. Despite being sidelined for quite a lot of the film, but the reason is explained. The reason is essential to the story. We'll say that right now.
Yeah.
Kind of wish she was in it a bit more, but which is odd because the book, which I haven't read, I've read the back cover, but I did a little research in it. The book focuses more on Molly. The film does not. And I think the focus on Ernest's character played by Leo DiCaprio, I think it feels a little bit off kilter. And I think, this is personally me, I think the Osage are now secondary focus in their own story, which I thought was a little odd. Not to say Scorsese shouldn't have been the one to direct this, not at all. But the Osage, I don't know, they just seemed a little naive throughout. You've got, again, I cannot, throughout the film, and again, this is the beauty of being a viewer. We know what's going on. We know who is who and what their motivations are. But I could not believe in this film that not one person picked up on who was pulling the strings here. I could not believe it. I was like, this is making this tribe, this culture, a little bit silly. And wasn't a huge fan of that. But I don't also believe in pigeonholing and saying, well, only an Osage director could have made this. Not at all. I don't think that's the case whatsoever. And apparently there was a lot of consultants on set to ensure accuracy, which I think is extremely important. Robert De Niro, I think Robert De Niro, like you, I think he's got a really cool presence to him. He's very menacing in this film. His accent isn't, but I think it's Robert De Niro in a Scorsese film, other than his fake fighting in The Irishman. You kind of attuned now to expect something decent out of him. Leonardo DiCaprio guns and scowls his way through the film. I think he's good. I don't think this is his best performance by any means.
Yeah.
I sent a message to John calling him Dane DiCaprio or Leonardo DeHaan because I couldn't get over the fact that he looked like Dane DeHaan throughout quite a lot of this film. It was off-putting. And I had a hot take during it, and I don't know if you'll agree with me or not, JB. Here we go. For me, I think this film could have actually been elevated by switching Jesse Plemons and Leo DiCaprio's roles around. I think if you swap those, Jesse Plemons, when he's got that authentic Southern drawl anyway. I would have loved to see him because I believe when this film was initially announced or when Jesse Plemons was cast, the rumours were that he was the lead in this film or at least had a significant leading role. Now, I can't say he has in this throughout, but I would have loved to have seen him in DiCaprio's role for this time around and have Leo come in and play that role. I think for me that probably would have made it a little bit stronger, but I loved the chemistry between DiCaprio and Gladstone. That's all in the trailers. There's a lot of Goodfellas about this, just with different settings. There is a lot of Scorsese-ness. He's an old timer and he's going to fall back on old habits. In fact, there's a certain scene in this film which is almost a shot by shot recreation of a scene in Goodfellas in towards that final third of the film. I think, okay, the film looks incredible. Let's get that out of the way now. The cinematography in this film is incredible. Rodrigo Prieto does this. This film is stunning. We did an episode of Movie Astrology recently where we spoke about Westerns and how more often than not, you can count on them looking sumptuous, looking so good. And this film is great. It's not just the landscapes on offer, it's the techniques used to bring them to life, the high shots, the wide shots, the establishing, the crane, the drones, everything used. Really, 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 really inventive use of the camera. And the music by long-term collaborator Robbie Robertson is also very, very, very decent. However, I think another thing I found when I said that I think this is an astonishingly good 2 hours, two and three quarter hour film, it says too much repetition for me in the dialogue or sometimes the visuals. You'll get people plotting or planning or scheming or just talking, and they'd be discussing or describing something, and then they'd almost repeat it either at the same time or later on to seemingly to ensure that the audience knows everything that's going on, so nobody's left in the dark. And I think there was too much of that going on, or there was too much of the dialogue felt, I want to say, hand-holdy almost, especially to, and again, that part at the very end as well. I don't know, but that's one of the things I think they could have cut down on is, let's give the audience some credit here and let things unfold about, even when there's kind of these atrocities going on and we're told about them, later on we are then shown scenes of them happening as well. And it's kind of like the Oppenheimer thing where some people wanted to see the Hiroshima stuff. I didn't. I think the way they did it there was great. I think we could have had a little bit more restraint here and just, you know, a bit more. Sometimes telling and not showing can be just as important, but that's something I picked up on. Was it bad? No, because the actors who were delivering it were doing very good work. Yeah, Brendan Fraser, not what the hell he was doing, just bellowing his way through, burping his way through. The final parts of the film now, again, we're not going to do spoilers. So I think the scene that you mentioned where there are two people faces kind of sitting down and discussing something that's happened in the film, and one of them asks them a direct question of which they need the, or they know the answer to, like we do now.
Yeah.
Stunning, sensationally good scene. Excellent.
So
scene
powerful.
Involved. So tense, so upsetting, so heartbreaking. And it kind of makes you just cry for humanity at that moment a little bit. Excellent. And you could have ended it there and you've got your ending and you could have had your title cards come up or your flashcards. Instead, we get the scene that you mentioned and the score says enough of it all at the end. It kind of took me out of that film a bit moment because it's breaking the fourth wall and then there's essentially calling time on your film and just, Hitchcock would introduce the film at the beginning. This felt like the opposite of that. Like Scorsese coming in to say, right, I'm going to end the film now by saying this. It didn't really feel like a particularly natural ending, even though we got a really nice and a really powerful helicopter shot next. I thought this really odd idea. At first I thought, I wonder if this was like a COVID thing, because I know it had a lot of issues during COVID where they had to push production. I was like, I wonder if they had to shoot this like this because they couldn't get everyone back. But then I thought, no, that's ridiculous, because the pulling power says they absolutely would have got everyone back. So it's an artistic design and I didn't dislike it. I didn't hate it. It was very jarring though, the whole thing. It looked great. Let's not forget the production design is great.
It's very cool.
It's very cool. It's a very interesting way of doing it. And I guess I don't want to say I prefer it over title cards, because if we had that scene that we both agree is like scintillatingly heartbreaking at the end, that's such a powerful scene. If you fade to black there and have the information said in that finale in kind of black screen white text, I almost think that would have been just as hard hitting when we find out the aftermath of what happened and just how goddamn infuriating justice can be sometimes. I think it would have been even more hard hitting if the final thing we see was those characters face to face and in that moment. But it's really, I think it's really well, a lot of it is really well done. I don't want to sit here and say that there are aspects of this I don't like, JB. The runtime, I don't think it needed to be 3.5 hours long, but that said, I wasn't sitting there looking at my clock. I think it's paced well enough, apart from that second act, which I do think slows down a bit. I think the performance
Scorsese's, sorry, but just with the pacing, he said he took inspiration from Astor's Midsommar and Bo is Afraid.
Yes,
which I saw because of like the erratic kind of stressful pacing of those films, like he wanted us to have that. And I did feel like the editing was a little erratic in the point that I was having a hard time. How long were we with them? Like it felt like we were just with them for a few weeks. And it was like years had gone by. Yes. And I was having a hard time like sussing that out because of the erratic pacing, which apparently was what he was going for. He wanted us to feel kind of confused and uncertain about all of the details. Yeah. And
that's not for me, that JB. In a film like Midsommar, I think you can get away with that because the whole thing is a psychedelic trip, and
the characters are losing track of time because it's 24 hours of sunlight,
exactly, and they're losing track of their minds as well because they're on stuff half the time in the film. So I think it works conceptually quite well there. I don't think it works as well here for the reasons you said. So I think the dialogue for the most part, or the screenplay for the most part, is good. I just think there's too much repetition. The performances across the board are very strong, some exceptionally good. Lily Gladstone and also Leonardo DiCaprio does get a shouty moment, don't worry. He also got paid a He also got paid a backup fee as well to help him get through the film, I heard, because his on-screen partner was over 25, so he had to get paid a bit of extra there to get him through it, good old Leo DiCaprio. But there's nothing here I watched and thought, yeah, this stinks. It's a great-looking film. It's an extremely important story, which I think the legacy of this film is people now maybe think, wow, this is something in American history, which a brutal chapter of it, which we didn't know about, and now we do. So good performances, great cinematography, one great performance. I enjoyed the music, JB. The runtime, too long, but I have seen more egregious instances of it this year. And listen, I'm just glad we get to see Scorsese doing what he wants to do and not shackled by the studio system. I just wonder what the bloody hell Brendan Fraser was doing. But if you want an emotional, heavy film, this is the one for you. But like John said, it isn't an enjoyable film. You're not going to go in and get The Wolf of Wall Street here or something like that. This is not a film which is enjoyable. Though there are moments of comedy in this, which I think...
There are.
I could have done without that, though, because I think this film is so heavy. I think I actually would have just preferred that tone rather than trying to lighten up a little bit. But overall, John, I liked it, didn't love it, but it's still going to get a very high. It'd probably still be a 4 out of 5 for me, though.
Yeah, and I would say a lot of the humor is at the expense of Leonardo DiCaprio's character. Like, we're supposed to view him as kind of an idiot. I don't know if it's necessary, although I did laugh. A lot of the humor is also early. When you're not quite sure how awful this movie's going to, like, not awful as in the movie is bad, but like how awful the story is going to get. Cause you're like, I was very uncertain what I was getting into when I saw this, but nevertheless, agreed. Very good film, for me, and Scorsese, again, a filmmaker I tend to vibe with. So, that's our review of Killers of Flower Moon. If you haven't seen it yet, we're not doing a spoiler app, but we did a good job of discussing the whole film without giving specifics of results and such. But it's a story I think everyone should hear. So even if it's bad, it's painful to hear, but it should be heard. And I'm glad at least it is now out there in some way.
I agree, my friend. The only comment I would like to say is I've seen so too many people online before the film came out already hailing this as a masterpiece. And I know I think sometimes we're too quick to hail films as a masterpiece, and a lot of that is X or Twitter. I think people, and also Letterboxd as well. A lot of people do just see the director and think this is good. This has to be 5 stars, and I do think sometimes there is a little bit of disingenuous side to that. But and again, it is all subjective. But sometimes I think there's a bit of hyperbole when it comes to a Nolan or Scorsese, and the same for actors as well. Maybe I'm part of the problem with certain directors as well. But I've just seen a lot of people saying that this is going to change your life. This is the best film of the decade, of the century, and to them it might be. But I sometimes feel it's a little bit performative. Go in with open expectations, and hopefully you enjoy it. You know, like we did.
I hope so. Well, folks, we're going to move on to our next segment. That's Chopped Headlines. These are movie or pop culture news that caught our attention, except that's not true this week. Like, if you've been listening for the month of October, our headlines are related to the podcast because we are in the middle of our Horror Movie Havoc first ever bracket for the month of October. We have picked 31 horror films, 15 from Matt, 15 from me, and then the best overall rated film on Letterboxd that is also on Shudder that we did not pick, which was Possession. And we have put them in a bracket, pairing them off throughout the month. We are in round 2, the Sweet 16, and we're about halfway through the Sweet 16. So we're going to go through the results so far. This episode, we're going to be talking about Ringu versus The Changeling, Pulse versus Dark and the Wicked, the Lake Mungo versus Ginger Snaps, Revenge versus Goodnight Mommy, and What Josiah Saw versus The Babadook. Now, we've already talked about all of these movies previously because they've all already been through a round. They've survived. These are the movies that won. Round 2 is here, and we've gotten through those events. So if you haven't been keeping up, Matt votes, I vote, and then we have a vote on Twitter and Instagram that you can vote on, and it's whoever gets the most votes moves on to the next round.
Sometimes, haven't we?
Yeah, several times. Matt and I have been divided. We're not always picking the movies that we picked. I had picked about half of the ones I picked I had never seen before, so I didn't necessarily have an opinion on them until I've seen them all now. That was one of our rules. We could not vote for a movie we had not seen. Yes. And you'd have to go with whatever the other person voted. So I made sure I saw all of them before any of the votes took place. It was a lot up front.
The bracket is picked, and the bracket is determined by ratings, and it's seeded in that way. We're not just randomly saying Changeling versus this film. This is the way that they do them.
And now, I mean, the bracket did its job, and it sorted them accordingly. So, like, Matt's number one pick played my number 15 pick, and vice versa. My number one played his 15, and it works its way into the middle. But now we're getting pair-ups that are going to be challenging, because now it's winner-take-all. So, Ringu versus the Changeling. Matt actually voted for Ringu, which was my movie, and I voted for the Changeling, which was Matt's movie. But I was underwhelmed by Ringu, and I really loved The Changeling, so it was an easy vote for me. So it came down to the audience, and you guys voted for The Changeling. And so it advances to the Elite Eight. It was the first film to advance. And we then went, do you have any comments on that particular matchup, Matt? I don't want to rush through this too much.
No, I don't feel too devastated that my pick in Ringu didn't win. The Changeling is a fantastic film, so happy to see it go through JB. And the next one, though, I'm glad that this one won, JB.
So Pulse versus The Dark and the Wicked. Now I am having some memory bias, apparently, because both Host and The Dark and the Wicked I have very high ratings on Letterboxd. But my memory has faded on both of those films, and so I don't know. I don't feel like the attachment to them. I feel like if they had left the impact where I remember them vividly, I would easily vote for them. And so I voted for Pulse. Matt voted for The Dark and the Wicked, and listeners, you guys voted for The Dark and the Wicked, so it advances. I have no problem with that. But I'd seen Pulse most recently, so I was like, well, that movie seems pretty impressive. I'm going to vote for that again.
I can't remember the outlet now. It was a pretty big one. It was one of the big outlets who had, and you know, these stories are always a little bit hokey to me, but it was 25 films that will get you, that will elevate your pulse to kind of unnatural levels. And one of the films on there was The Dark and the Wicked. It's a film that I still don't think many people have seen, but I'm constantly seeing it appear on these kind of lists of, this is an exceptionally scary film. This is taut, atmospheric, tense, one of the best films of the horror films of the last 5-10 years or so. But I still don't think it's actually kind of broken through that much, if you know what I mean. So hopefully, maybe even if it doesn't win, we can get a few more eyes on it.
Yeah, it's one of those films. We saw it at Fantasia Fest, if I remember correctly.
That's right, yeah.
Online. And it stayed with me then. I read my review recently because I was trying to refresh my memory on the movie, because we watched a lot of movies that week because it was a festival. So it was like bombarded. And that was, I think, 2020. So I've seen a lot of movies, as I've mentioned. So, but yeah, it's clearly got its following. And if you haven't seen it, I think it is obviously all of these movies are on Shudder, except I don't remember which one wasn't here in the States. There was like one issue early, but it was on
Prime. Lake Mungo, I think.
Possibly. And Dark and the Wicked, though, is on Shudder, so check it out. Might try to rewatch it if I can fit it into my busy schedule here. Next up, though, Lake Mungo versus Ginger Snaps. Now, I did a other podcast, Burke Reviews Movie Club, covered Lake Mungo years ago. Again, I have a positive rating. I haven't re-listened to the episode to hear my thoughts on it. I remember parts of it. I don't remember all of it. So again, I went with the more recent film that I had been wanting to watch for a while, and I really liked Ginger Snaps. So I voted for Ginger Snaps. Matt and you audience members, you voted for Lake Mungo. So it advances, and that gives us our first Elite Eight matchup. It's going to be a Changeling versus Lake Mungo. A powerful matchup, apparently. I think both deal with ghosts, right?
In kind of one, well, excuse the kind of odd pun, but one form or another. That's going to be tough. Mm-hmm. And we do have, on next week's episode, we do have a couple of heavyweight clashes to go through as well. But when we get to this stage of the bracket, the films that are left should be, you'd hope, of a particularly high quality. And someone like Lake Mungo and Ginger Snaps, so like, tonally different films, and they're both Excellent. And it's one of those funny ones where if you put Ginger Snaps and me against some of the other ones, I choose it there and then. But Lake Mungo strangled me when I saw it. And even now, it's the feeling I get from remembering it and watching it the first time was so devastating that that wins like a point or two more for me, which is why I had to choose it. But goddamn, I do like Ginger Snaps.
I think it's worth noting too that pretty much all the movies on this list are good. Like I think the lowest rated one was like a 3.1.
We did well picking those.
Yeah. Now I didn't like all of them. I didn't like The Color Out of Shape very much, and I didn't like how Come True ended. Although I liked a lot of Come True at first, and then it progressively lost me. And then there's been some movies that I had. Like Reanimator, I had painted a very different picture of what that movie would be, and I really enjoyed it. And I just saw a film I'm going to talk about in a little bit that is by the same writer of Reanimator and has a lot of Reanimator elements in it that I also kind of clicked with. Point being, like, no matter who ends up winning this, whichever film becomes the first ever champion, that's not to say any of these films aren't good, or again, like Matt said, you mix up a matchup and that film might advance where it just couldn't hear. Ginger Snaps being one of those possible. Like maybe if it had gone up against Pulse, maybe Ginger Snaps moves on. Who knows?
True.
Which is, I think, the case with this one. Revenge versus Goodnight Mommy. This one was the tightest we have had, I think, in the entire bracket so far. Matt voted for his Goodnight Mommy. I voted for Revenge. Revenge is more my, I don't know, I really liked the revenge part of it. Like it just really,
it's
so visceral and brutal and
so much blood.
Yeah, and there's some really interesting filmmaking in Revenge, like some weird camera stuff that I thought was kind of compelling.
Goodnight Mommy, though, my friend. It's creepy, unsettling, so terrifying. What a twist. Which is why I loved Revenge when I saw it. This was tough. So we had to ask you guys. You please separate us guys. And you didn't.
Audience was split down the middle on both Instagram and Twitter. So we ended up with a draw. And our rules for the draw are whichever film has the higher letterbox rating advances. Revenge squeaks out, has a 3.5. Goodnight Mommy has a 3.4. Wow. So it could not have been tighter. But Revenge wins by technicality.
If they both had the same letterbox score, what do we do then? Flip a coin?
You know what? I was hoping that wouldn't happen. Yeah. It might happen. I guess we flip a coin if that occurs.
Nearly did. That was this is the beauty of these films, though, is that whereas they may not be like juggernauts in terms of films that the whole world has seen, Goodnight Mommy and Revenge are bloody good horror films. And it would seem that we think that, you guys think that, and the letterbox guys think that as well. And that's the great thing about doing a bracket like this, is when it's not even about something versus something, despite we have to market that. Yeah, let's just celebrate all of these films.
Yeah.
I mean, even the next one, JB, which was, this was a clean sweep across the board. But that isn't
the first one in the Elite Eight.
Yeah, the first, exactly, the first one. And
Sweet 16, sorry.
That in the Sweet 16, that is the strength of the bracket as well, that we are still struggling to separate these films. However, when we got to What Josiah Saw, very good film, versus The Babadook, it swept it. It is, and again, not to say that The Babadook is, you know, infinitely better than What Josiah Saw, because What Josiah Saw is actually a really good film. It's a Shudder original. And I'm so glad that, as mentioned it before, that we're getting, or at least up until this point, we have had Shudder original films in this Sweet 16, and maybe even going forward into the Elite Eight. We're getting some more of those actual like streaming original films going in, which then proves that Shudder can hold its own against the big boys. Hey, however, though, JB, The Babadook was a clean sweep, and I mean, it would be stupid to say we can't argue with that, because we both went for it, didn't we?
Yeah, and I was a person who, when my first viewing of The Babadook, I was kind of on the fence, and it's through study and reading and rewatching that I've become a huge fan of The Babadook, and I'm excited to see it sweep. Especially, it was my pick, but I was excited to see other people agreeing with me so far, and so. we didn't say this, but currently for the Elite Eight, we have two matchups set. The Changeling versus Lake Mungo, the Dark and the Wicked versus Revenge. The Babadook will be competing against the winner of Possession in VHS 94, which will be coming out in a couple of days for the vote. Currently on your social media, I guess it's already passed by the time you're hearing this, the Autopsy of Jane Doe versus Host, and then Halloween versus Wreck. The winners of those will be competing against each other. So yeah, some big matchups on the way.
Yeah, looking forward. Actually, I'm not looking forward to doing the results of some of those because, you know, some is like picking between your favorite kids. Some of them, Halloween versus Wreck is a titanic battle, and that's only in the second round. So yeah, it's going to be tough going forward, but I'm digging it. So yeah, please guys do jump on the Instagram and Twitter polls, Instagram stories and the Twitter feed on the BAMP. We'll give out all the social links at the end, but please do join in because we want to do it again next year. And we've already got ideas on how to widen the scope next year as well. But to be fair, it's going to be tough to find already. I'm looking at this list of 31 films. I think, man, we're going to try and beat that next year. Good luck.
Yeah. Well, listeners, that's our essentially chopped headlines, our own headline. We're going to move on to our last segment. Well, technically last segment, media consumption, movies, TV, video games, music, podcasts, things that we do to pass the time between recordings. Matt, what have you been consuming since the last time we recorded?
Well, like you said, JB, we haven't had as much time in between recordings. Usually we'd have an extra few days in order to watch some stuff. So mine's been really quite short. I listened to Nightmare on Film Street. I listened to Watch Double Toasted on YouTube. And that's about it in terms of podcasts. I haven't really listened to much. Again, I don't really listen to them unless I have a commute to do, and I haven't really had one in the last week to 10 days. So I've been a little bit lacking on that side. But in terms of, I've been playing EA Sports FC 24, or FIFA, as it used to be called. I've been playing that with my buddies online. That's what's taken up most of the time. Of course, we do that in the evening. I have, though, downloaded Disney's Speed Sport. Is that what it's called? Speed Sport?
Yeah, a Speed Storm.
Speed Storm. Damn, I told my brother it's called Speed Sport. Speed Storm. So I've got that downloaded. So now I need to speak to this guy for anonymity's sake. I'll just call him John B and sort out a time to get on there and race against each other and get some, yes, get some BAMP competitiveness going. So I'd like to play that very soon. And films, not much, not really that all that lot, other than Killers of the Flower Moon, because that took up my entire Saturday evening. I've watched Alfie from 1966 and The Professionals from 1966 in preparation for Movie Astrology. We've either now dropped or we're about to drop part two of our six-part 1966 coverage. If Movie Astrology has now changed, where we're going to be covering a year in film still, but we're splitting up into six monthly episodes. The first episode is a quick intro to the year and talking about the notable releases. And then episodes 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 are covering the top 10 highest grossing films, 2 per year. So 10 to 9, 8 to 7, so on and so forth. On this episode, we are both chatting about Alfie and The Professionals. So please go check that out. It's on Spotify. It's on YouTube. Subscribe to Movie Astrology on YouTube as well. We'd love to. We've only just started, so we're very fledgling. So any subscribers we can get on there and likes and comments, positive ones, would be so well appreciated, guys. So yeah, check that out. Check out Movie Astrology on all the socials for all the details there. But the other film I saw, this is probably why I didn't see any other films this week, because I just didn't think I could bring myself to after this, JP. Last week you'd mentioned watching When Evil Lurks and how much it whipped you into shape a little bit. You know, you found When Evil, this is one that, how do I put it? Well, it traumatized you. That's your words, isn't it, John?
Yeah, it is.
Yeah, and as somebody who loves horror and thinks that I've been there, seen it, done it all, nothing scares this guy. Nothing apart from Evil Dead Rise. Nothing gets me anymore. I watched it when Evil Lurks, got the screener from our guys at the PR team. Got to put my review out. It's an Argentinian horror film, like John mentioned, and my word, was this an experience. John mentioned that there were a handful of moments. He didn't tell me any of them, but he said there are a handful of moments which are just kind of jaw-dropping, yet they went there kind of horror moments, and one specifically, which he kind of tried to warn me about in a roundabout way, and that one, it whipped me as well. I can't give any spoilers, but there are moments in this where they They really push the boundaries and they show that they're not afraid to break a few taboos. And it's a tough watch. It's a heavy watch. It's a tough watch. It's satisfying in a way by the time that they get to the end of the film, because it kind of feels like, well, this is the natural progression of what would actually happen by the time we get to the end. But really heavy, really tough, fantastic horror film, When Evil Lurks. If you are frightened of subtitles, get over yourself very quickly, because some of the best horror you'll see out there is in a foreign language. When Evil Lurks is another great example of that. I'm so glad that JB took the screener and watched it on a whim, because I had it and just didn't think to request it. As soon as JB said he was into it and loved it, well, it made him feel all the things. I was like, yeah, I need to get on board with this. So recommend When Evil Lurks is coming. Again, we're not sponsored by Shudder, we promise you. We'd like to be if the next horror movie have it, guys, but this is coming out on Shudder by, I think it's the end of this week upon release of this podcast.
Yeah, I think you're right.
The end of this week. So do check it out. Put your phone away. Just watch the film. Get scared. It's almost Halloween. This is a good one to watch in the lead up to it. So a couple of completely different films there. Alfie, a film, well, Alfie is Alfie. All our thoughts on Movie Astrology to Professionals, a Western. Just seen a kind of American crime Western with Killers of the Flower Moon, and then a devastating horror film in When Evil Lurks. So bit of a mixed bag, JB. And then by the time we get to our next episode, I'm sure there'll be a little bit more meat on the bones for my consumption. But what about yourself? Because you're never shy on a few bits of consumption.
I mean, I have been busier than I've actually been playing a lot of video games, and that's where a lot of the time I would be watching movies has been given to. Blank Check, I work out Sunday morning. My ritual is I wake up, the new episode of Blank Check is downloaded. I listen to it while I eat my breakfast. I go to the gym. I listen to it while I'm at the gym, and nice. I usually finish it right after I will walk the dogs or whatever when I get back. And that's what happened. They did The Curious Case of Benjamin Button as we are continuing the David Lynch series. And then yesterday they had dropped the World Is Not Enough commentary. I've watched those movies, so I'm listening to the commentaries. I always enjoy the commentaries. That's a Patreon thing. But Suitable Flesh is the movie I alluded to a few minutes ago. I think it's director Joe Lynch.
Yes, it is.
It stars Barbara Crampton and Heather Graham and Judah, he's in the Babysitter and another thing that we reviewed, if I remember correctly. But I at first was not feeling the movie. I was very much like, this feels like real B movie. And then it kind of falls. You get to why it feels that way, and it makes a lot of sense. And the movie really, there's a lot of cool stuff, very cool horror things. Heather Graham, I don't think I've ever seen Graham in a horror film. I think of Austin Powers. I think she's fine in The Spy Who Shags Me. Obviously her big movie was Roller Girl, or a big role was Roller Girl in Boogie Nights. She's in The Hangover, but like a lot of times I think we don't think of Heather Graham as like top tier, and it starts that way where you're like, oh man, she's really just reading the lines off of a script. And that it by the end, I was like, oh, she's actually pretty good in this. And Barbara Crampton, I've become a mega fan of Barbara Crampton, dude. Like I've explored a lot of 80s horror. Yeah. And man, she is very pigeonholed, right? Like she does this type of character. But I do enjoy her. I think she brings something to those roles that other actresses maybe wouldn't have. It feels like she's trying, you know, like she's taking it seriously, not too serious. She's having fun with it, but she's not like, oh, I'm stuck in this. Like she's like, I'm going to act. I'm going to, you know, and from what I've seen on her socials, she very much embraces being that. It comes across, and it's nice. Like, I don't know. Horror is such a interesting genre to explore, because if you talk to fans of horror, they, you know, like Matt, you guys hold it with high regard. And then there are like fans of horror, but they're very elitist fans, right? They only like certain horror. And I would probably fall more into that bracket. And then there are people who just think the worst of horror, that it's filth, it's trash, it's, you know, has no place in cinema. And I think a lot of that attitude permeates when you talk about actors who are explicitly in that genre, and Crampton obviously being one of them. But like, when you, she seems very happy with her career and her, and it comes across. And you know, there are definitely actors who have been stuck in it, and you can tell they don't want to do it. They do it because it's a paycheck, and that stinks. I don't, no one's job should feel like that, right? Like, in any industry, I would love for everyone to like what they do. It definitely, especially if you work with people, it's way better if you actually like doing that job than if you don't. Like waitresses, like, you can tell the difference of a waitress who does it because they need money and those who actually enjoy the process. But Suitable Flesh, man, it won me over. My review's up at burkereviews.com, but it, really cool movie. Again, it's for horror fans, though. It's not going to be for those who don't like horror, especially, I think, fans of Reanimator, I think, will click with some of the stuff in this movie. The opening shot is Barbara Crampton looking into a body bag, and you are the camera is in the body bag. Like, the film is all black, and then you see the light as it unzips, and you're looking up from the body bag, and it's a really cool shot. There's a lot of, like, really innovative filmmaking in it that I thought was pretty cool.
Nice. It's one of the films which I requested at, I think it's Fantasia and Tribeca, I think, but they were not given away screeners.
Well, it's coming to Shudder, so you might want to hit up your contact.
Shudder, there we go. I'll check the old screener account. Hopefully it'll be in there. But yeah, that's given me more momentum to watch it now. So yeah, hopefully it's decent.
The next two things I can't talk about any specifics, I'm under embargo, but my reviews for both will be up at Disappointment Media this week, I think. One is a documentary, and it's, I think, well, I'll just say what it is. It's called Subject. Okay. And it's a documentary about documentary film. They are interviewing previous subjects of big successful documentaries, specifically five. The Wolfpack, a documentary I have talked about and taught many times, and have extensive knowledge of that film. They are talking to Makunda from that specifically, but oh, and the mother, whose name I'm not going to remember right now. But they talk to, I'm going to forget all five documentaries. It's the Wolfpack, Hoop Dreams, The Staircase, which is, I think, a docu-series more so than a singular documentary. Mm-hmm. The Case of the Freedmans, which is one I had not heard of, and The Square, which I'd heard of but have not seen, which is a film about the Egyptian turmoil, or the, I can't think of the better phrase for that right now. But so they're focusing on those five and the subjects from those films and how being subjects of a documentary that was extremely successful changed their lives, basically, and posing ethical questions about, when we make documentaries, what is the role of the filmmaker? What is the role of society? What is, you know, what are the expectations that the subject should have with the filmmaker? It's a very meta kind of commentary on the process of documentary film. So any fans of that genre should keep Subject on their radar and see it when you can. Again, that's not giving any actual opinions of the film, just saying that's what the film is about. That's what it is marketed as, and it will be coming out sometime soon. So there's no critical commentary on my part from Subject there.
A documentary about documentaries is the most John Burke thing I've ever heard.
Yeah, dude, for a film teacher, even if I'm currently not teaching film, but a person who will forever be a person who tries to get people to appreciate cinema at a higher level, yeah, it's 100% made for someone like me. If I were still teaching film, this would already be like, well, how can I teach this? Can I have it now? Because this is literally, I talk about so many of the things that this film is addressing when I teach documentary film. So like, this would be, it frustrates me that I'm not teaching film, because I immediately know where I would put this in a lesson plan. But without, again, saying if it's good or bad, no comment. I am reviewing a TV series for the first time. I've reviewed a couple of series over the course of Burke Reviews, but generally speaking, I don't review series. But one show a while ago, about maybe 2 years ago, grabbed me, called Letterkenny.
Mm-hmm.
I'm a big fan of Letterkenny. I've watched all, I think it's 12 seasons now. And they're short seasons. It's an easy watch. They're like 20-minute episodes, and it's basically just rapid fire comedy that somehow still has story. The way Jared Kiso has managed to tell story through character actions and weird comedic, like it's literally like minutes of just people riffing, and somehow it feels like characters, in real ways. Like, it's, I'm so enamored with Letterkenny. Letterkenny, last year, we got a spinoff series called Shoresy. I was equally a fan of Shoresy season one. And I got to do Shoresy season two. Now, that's going to be dropping here in the States on Hulu on the 27th. All six episodes for the season. It's a short. That's why I decided to do it. It's six 20-minute episodes. So it's basically, it's shorter than Killers on the Flower Moon. And for an entire season of a TV series.
That's wild. So
it is when you frame it that way, right? Like, but I only
Killers of the Flower Moon and not a whole series of TV.
Yeah, I've only seen the five of the six episodes, which was frustrating, because now I have to wait until Friday to see the final. But I can't say if it's good or bad, but my review will be up at Disappointment Media. And then lastly, much like anybody who is a video gamer, I bought Spider-Man 2 and have started playing that. I am not super far into it. It is clearly very good. I will say my one comment on the entire trilogy. There's three games from this franchise, right? There's Spider-Man, there's Spider-Man Miles Morales, and there's Spider-Man 2 now. I think the game suffers because of Spider-Verse. And I say that because the Miles we get in the game is not the same Miles we got in the movie, and I very much like the Miles in the movie more than the Miles in the games. I don't dislike Miles in the game, but I definitely would like, you're not as cool as the Miles from the movie. Like, I would much rather be playing
cool in the film, isn't he?
He's so cool. And this one, I'm like, I don't love you as much. Like, I like him, but I know there's another one, and it's like the other one is cooler. I miss that guy.
How far through the game are you?
It's hard to tell because I like being Spider-Man when I play the game. So like, much like I very much like Hogwarts Legacy because I like being a wizard in the wizarding world. So I'm doing too many side quests. So it's slowing me down because I'm like, also part of the nature of the side quest is like you're swinging to the next story mission, right?
Yeah.
But then like over here, there's a crime. You're like, well, I got to stop that crime. I can't swing past the crime.
No.
That would be wrong.
And you've got to go to hook and ladder at least once.
Yeah, it's so easy to get distracted playing that game. Especially because in the early parts of the game, you don't have a way to fast travel. So you have to like swing through the city, or they have added some other traveling type mechanisms that I won't say because it's very early in the game, but still I feel like I didn't know going into the game that this was going to be a travel component. And it's a major change from the previous two games as a travel component. But so like I'm exploring the city to get to the next story mission, but then I have to do all this. Like, well, I'll go ahead and get these three side quests because they're right here. And then also because you want to unlock all the things, and you can't unlock all the things if you don't do all the side quests. So it slows me down a lot. I probably played for like 4 hours over the last 2 days.
Nice. And I only asked because two people I know who have played the game, I think I mentioned this the other day, said that because I asked him, you know, I haven't played it yet, I will do it at some point. You know, I said, what's it like? You know, everybody knows how good Miles Morales was in the first one. And both people actually surprisingly said, to start with, a little shaky, but when it gets going, you know, after the first couple of hours, it really kind of hits home and goes.
Yeah, I'm invested, but yeah, there's a few things where I'm like, this feels a little tedious, but in like an understandable way, because you see a lot of setup happening, and I'm like, okay.
As long as there's payoff in the end, then it's fine.
Yeah, but I should have played more. The reason I haven't played more is because of Speedstorm. I am very addicted to Disney Speedstorm. I've always liked Mario Kart, but I don't think any of the Mario Karts that I played had an online component. And while I'm not great at this, I lose quite a bit, and sometimes in frustrating ways where I'll be first, and then like the last second, I'm suddenly seventh. I want to unlock the racers, and like there's a lot of grindy stuff about it, but I have fun doing the grinding because every race is different, right? And the game does not seem to punish you for losing. You still get points to progression, even if you're dead last. Which I like, because if I was like dropping in ranks every time I lost, I would be so frustrated.
Not punished,
because
then. Yep.
Right, because even though it slows your progression down because you're not getting as many points, it's still this like positive affirmation, like, well, at least you showed up. It's like, thank you. And so it's it. Yeah, I'm having a blast, and I'm, you know, like, it's man, it's super grindy. Like, I can't sit here and act like if you want all the racers, it's going to take a lot of effort or a lot of money. I'm not investing money. I have paid. I think I said I paid for the annual or the subscription, the pass for like the season or whatever. Because you get more stuff when you do that, and it's like $10 for the season. That's what a lot of these games are doing, and the game's free. So like, I wouldn't, if I had paid $60 for this game, I wouldn't be compelled to pay $10 more. But I'm playing the game for free. $10 doesn't feel like so much to spend on a game I'm enjoying, especially. Like, I really want to play. Too much. I'm playing way too much. And again, because a race is fast. Like, you a race is like 3 or 4 minutes. And so you're just like, well, I'll just do one more. And then like 2 hours have gone by, you're like, oh crap, I've done a lot of races. But yeah, I like the game. So that's what I've been playing the most.
Yeah, no, I need to get on it. I need to play a few games, and then I'm guessing is it co-op or multiplayer or versus? Is there a mode for that?
Yes, it's not like so. It's not co-op. I don't think I have not partied up with anybody, but you can get a party of up to 3 racers, and then races are 8 people. I assume you can do like a private race if you want to, but like you can party up and then do a rank match or party up and do. They have one a mode that is. I forget what it's called, but it basically gives all of the racers are at level 30 regardless. Yeah. So it like balances out the playing field. But the prizes are less for that, where like the ranked, you are, if your racer is like level 7 and you're up against a level 25, good luck. You might not win, but again, there's no penalty for not winning. You just won't get as many points. But you get other prizes for that mode that are better. So like you kind of, you have to hedge. What are you looking to get? But yeah, I definitely want to play, Matt. We gotta sync up.
Yes, sir. Yeah, I need to start playing more games and start justifying the cost of this PS5, my friend. But I'm glad to hear you enjoying it.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. It's good times. But that's it for consumption, folks. We are gonna wrap up. Before we leave, we have to check in with each other, make sure we're doing something to stay bloody awesome, because if we're gonna keep doing this show, we gotta make sure our levels are up there. So Matt, I need to know, what have you been doing to stay bloody awesome?
Oh, sorry you woke me up, John. I have been sleeping. I know it sounds really stupid, but also we've had less time since the last episode to be bloody awesome. But I've had a weekend off of doing anything this weekend, which is a blessing, you know, as much as I want to do things with my kid. And that is a blessing sometimes to just be able to sleep. And I have made the most of it. I've been so tired in the last week. I've been getting over a cold. And it's the dregs that just won't go away, you know, having to get up early like everyone and go to work and toil away and then come back, and then your body never quite has a chance to chill out. I have been making the most of it. I wouldn't say I've been sleeping in, because at the age we are now, you know, lay in seems to be about 8 o'clock max, but just making the most of getting as much sleep as possible, or being able to switch the alarm off, get an extra hour or two in, or at very worst, it's sort of like laying in bed and just, you know, doom scrolling through YouTube or something and just chilling out a bit more. That's pretty much it. Other than recording podcasts with John Burke, that's pretty much it, my friend, is getting some sleep in. But what about you? I'm sure you've done something pretty sharp.
Yes, good pun. Listeners, you may not know this. I don't know if you've ever bothered to look us up, but I am bald. I have been bald pretty much since I was 21. And by bald, I do shave my head, but I shave my head out of vanity, because I started going bald in the center of the top of my head very young, like age 20, it started thinning. And by 22, it was noticeable. So it was like, you know what, I'm just going to shave it off. And so I haven't been to a barbershop or a hairstylist in over 20 years. I've been shaving my own head for 20 years, mostly successfully. I did, Matt, I don't know if I've ever told you about this failed experiment. I bought this thing called the head blade that was like a ring that you put on your finger. And the idea was that you just kind of like swipe your head and it'll like easily shave. I almost died. I cut myself so many times with that stupid thing.
It sounds quite dangerous.
Yeah. In theory, it sounded like this will be easy. It was not. So went back to a regular razor, but I have shaved my head pretty much forever. And this year I've always had some type of facial hair, but I've always kept it kind of short and trim easy enough to buy a beard trimmer and do it yourself. I have decided to grow my beard long as a trend that a lot of people are doing. And I was like, yeah, I'm going to do it. I've always wanted to try it. Why not? And it's been growing long. If you watched our last astrology video, the first episode from 1966, you saw the very shaggy-ish beard. And I want it to still be clean but long. So I decided to try going to a barber and having my beard trimmed. And it was quite the experience. I very much enjoyed it. I used to love going to the hair salon as a kid, getting my hair cut and, you know, them shaving it. And it was a nice experience, especially, I don't know, Matt, how often you go to a stylist or whatever, but them washing my head was always like my favorite thing.
Stylist, John, is too expensive for me. Mine is the kind of $15 fade at the side and a little bit off the top, please. 15 minutes later, I'm done.
Yeah, I was surprised how long my barber took time to do my beard and stuff. So the new video, you will have seen, listener, that I had just gone to the barber that morning, I thought they did a great job. I'm probably going to do that at least once a month. I really want to let it grow. I do think it's maybe a little shorter than I wanted initially, but I want it to keep growing long but still being clean and trimmed. A new part of my life. I think I might be visiting a barber again once a month or so, and about the same price, Matt, just a beard trim, somewhere between, depending on which barber I go to, seems to be between $8 to $20. Inflation is real, folks. But yeah, that was my same bloody awesome. Keeping my beard maintained.
Keeping sharp. But when again, when we do astrology, we also have a video podcast on Spotify and YouTube. When John logged on pre-recording, I said to him before, so it's not new news to him, but you know, you notice something's different, but you can't quite put your finger on it, or you just don't want to kind of hazard a guess. I was like, something looks different. You know, so something there, he's still like an animalistically handsome man. I was like, something's different here. And then he mentioned that, you know, he'd had the grooming and the trimming done on the beard, and damn, it looks good. It does look sharp in every sense of the word. So, go check out JB's face.
Yes, exactly. And that's the episode, listeners. We'll be back next week with our review of the much, it's almost unbelievable that it's coming out. Five Nights at Freddy's movie is coming out. I don't know, Matt, what you have with this, but I've been a high school teacher for the last 13 years. And Five Nights at Freddy's, not only was my daughter super obsessed with those games when they first came out, but so many of my students were, that it's when they announced the movie, which I feel like was 7 years ago, it was like, how do you turn this game into a movie? It doesn't really feel like it's got like much of a story. There's like lore, but at the same time, and now there's been many games, there's been books written. The lore has been expanded, and I gotta say, the movie's trailer looks good. Like, I was surprised when the trailer dropped. I was like, oh, I actually kind of want to see this.
Well, I just hope they nail the atmosphere and the dread more so than any kind of gore as well. I just want to feel uncomfortable watching it.
Well, we got Josh Hutcherson is the lead, and why can't I not think of his name? Matthew Lillard is in it, which is always exciting. He hasn't starred in something in a while, but obviously I love him in Scream. I really liked him in SLC Punk. I actually have never sat through any of the live action Scooby-Doos all the way through, so I have no opinions.
They're fine. It's Scream, isn't it, man? I'll be right back. That's what it's all about.
Scream. It is. We're going to be talking Five Nights at Freddy's on our next episode. I have no attachment outside my daughter loved the game when I was a kid. Phone games did not exist because our phones were rotary. Nevertheless, we'll be here to talk about that. We want to hear your thoughts on Killers of the Flower Moon, on Brendan Fraser's yelling, on Five Nights at Freddy's, the franchise maybe even, or, you know, have you played Disney Speedstorm? Hit us up on socials. On Instagram, we're at Bloody Awesome Movie Pod. Twitter,
we are at BAMP underscore podcast, BAMP underscore podcast.
Facebook, you can find us by searching Bloody Awesome Movie Podcast. We also are available individually. You can find me at BurkeReviews.com or at BurkeReviews on all the social media platforms. And Matt?
whatiwatchtonight.co.uk, and just search for What I Watch Tonight across all of the socials, including Letterboxd.
And if you like the podcast, if you like what we're doing here at the Bloody Awesome Movie Podcast, we ask that you take just a moment and give us that 5-star rating on whatever podcast catcher you use to listen, because it helps other people find the show. And that is our goal at the end of the day. With that, we encourage you to keep watching movies
and stay bloody awesome.
Blood, 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 blood,